Well, you send in a number of questions, and I'll have a go at them. And some of them are good, some of them are not so good. But I can say that with impunity, because some of my answers will be good, and some of them won't be any good either. So there's nothing sort of self-assertive in that. I haven't tried to answer them. I just pulled a few of them because I knew we would have limited time, and some of you are leaving already because you must. And we won't delay this beyond quarter past, okay? So the drop dead on this is 12:15. If you're feeling like, oh golly, I need to go now. If you need to go before 12:15, you can leave any time. Someone says Loudoun County was named after Loudoun in Ayrshire. I figured that, but I'm glad to have it confirmed. We have mountains nearby. We have the ocean close by, just like your homeland. So why don't you and your wife just retire here? So, thank you for a really nice invitation. I'll give it due consideration. Any tips for an abundant marriage? Was it Stephen Covey that wrote In Search of Excellence? Was it? Yeah. If you remember that old book, the old business book, they surveyed all those companies. It's funny because many of them have gone south. But anyway, shows you how, you know, the wisdom of man ebbs and flows in the business world as well. But I remember at the end of that book that he said that despite the variety of companies, whether they were consulting or manufacturing, whatever they were doing, that each of the companies had certain things in common. And one of them was that all of these companies, despite what they did, quotes, did the basics well most of the time. They did the basics well most of the time. I guess my best tip for an abundant marriage is just that, to do the basics well most of the time. That means saying, I'm sorry. It means saying, please forgive me. It means not allowing the things that were endearing for us in the pursuit of our spouse to the point of marriage to just ebb out of things, just to slowly leak away. And I think if I observe the signs in our culture, the notion is that, you know, you can maintain meaningful relationships on the basis of sort of big bursts of enthusiasm, or, you know, spectacular trips, or, you know, whatever it is. But you know that's not the case. There's going to be nothing worse than flying all the way to Hawaii, you know, if you're not actually speaking to one another. I mean, stay in Alexandria and don't speak to one another. Don't waste all your money getting out there to prove the fact that you're not talking to one another. So, you know, it can be done, can it? I mean, it's in keeping short accounts with sin. It's in doing what I'm supposed to do. It's in, you know. Yeah, I've got no peculiar insight on that, except that at 37 years of marriage, which is where we are now, I mean, when I was the age of some of you, and somebody said they'd been married for 37 years, I'd be like, what the heck is that? You know, does anything work? I mean, what do you do? I mean, 37 years married. I mean, what do you talk about? What are you going to... I mean, this is terrible. That's how I used to think. I mean, I look at people and say, golden wedding. I'm like, whoa, I don't want... Golden wedding, what does that mean? Or it means you're just about dead. But I'm here to tell you that I'm having... We are having a heck of a time. I mean, it's good. It's really good. You know, your kids leave, you go, great. And you know, you just, I don't know, just have, Read your Bible, pray every day. love you. I mean, you just, what you got? You got two miserable sinners living in the one house. What chance have you got? I mean, it's hopeless. It's hopeless. To expand on one of your points last night, Henry Drummond once said, good Scotsman, strength of character may be learned at work, but beauty of character is learned at home. Can you elaborate or give practical examples of this? Note, I'm looking for things that hit us to our core, not vague descriptions. Okay. All right. Goodness gracious, you're a little pushy, aren't you? I can't think of anything. Well, it's a good question, isn't it? I mean, okay, so beauty of character is learned at home. Well, at home, everybody knows what everybody is, right? So when you go home, whatever you are, you might be a civil engineer and be involved in one of the great infrastructure projects in, you know, on the Eastern Seaboard. But you're just dad. You know, you're not going home and say, hello, the civil engineer has returned. I see the kitchen table is out of alignment here by a millimeter. I say, hey, shut up. And take your shoes off as well. And get the baseball mitt because we're going out. So suddenly, you know, all that stuff that you just brought, if you come home. So that's both the beauty of it and the challenge of it, isn't it? So that, this wasn't at home, this was on the plane, but it's a kind of at-home thing on the plane. Sue and I were flying to San Francisco a few weeks ago, and we sat down, and we sat behind a lady and a wee boy. We were delayed quite a while on the runway, and the little boy was very concerned about the plane because apparently it would go very fast. So he said to his mommy, Mommy, does the plane go very fast? She, knowing that he was afraid of it going fast, said, no, it doesn't, it goes very slowly. Right? So that I wanted to poke her and go, hey, wait a minute. But I can't do that. It's none of my business. Well, it's my business, but I can't do that. So anyway, she lied through her teeth to this kid. One of the stewardesses came to ask if you'd like something. And the boy asked the stewardess, does the plane go fast? Oh, yes, she says. It goes, and the mother's going. She goes, oh, yeah, goes really slowly. It's a very slow. And I turned to my wife and I said, when is this boy going to trust his mother? I mean, if you're going to lie about essential things like this, you don't say that. You say, well, it goes slowly and then it gets faster. And then when it gets going, really going, it feels like it's hardly going at all. You're going to love this. It's brilliant. Hold my hand. Here we go. But in order to make him feel comfortable, and in order to make her feel okay about herself, she just flat out lied to the kid. I can't imagine what his future will be like when he asks the next question about, does marijuana do anything to your head? Oh, no, it makes you feel groovy, you know. You're going to be... So honesty in the house. You can't be dishonest in little things in the house. Humility in the house. Your kids will pick up on if you've got a fat head. And they'll tell you. Which is fabulous. It's painful, but it's fabulous. I mean, I tell my congregation, this is actually coming to folklore in our congregation now, at least amongst my pastoral team. Because I remember it very vividly. I was driving in the car one day. I had the children in the back. My son, who was the oldest of the three, was most alert. And at some point, I must have decided that Mr. So-and-so, who was driving on the street, was not doing a very good job of it. And so I articulated just kind of what kind of job he was doing. And... without rolling my window down and, you know, I expressed myself in that way. And as I paused for breath, a voice came from the back seat and it said, and that's another kind word from your pastor. So. I don't know if that's concrete enough, but that's concrete enough for me as like... How did you come to settle in Cleveland? Slowly. Reluctantly. but eventually happily. A short story friend in California gave my name, unbeknownst to me, to a church that was in dire need. He gave it to them as a bit of a joke. They never got the joke. They followed up on it. And a man came out of the blue, literally out of the blue, and knocked the front door of our house in Scotland and announced the fact that he was from a church on the east side of Cleveland. He was with Lubrizol Corporation. He was on a business trip, and he wanted to meet me, and he met me 4 minutes before the start of the morning service, taken to the church by my wife, and he asked if I had any interest in having a move to another church. I said, you know, very graciously, I got an interest in the morning service, and beyond that, no, nothing. He said, well, let me ask you, are you open to God's will in your life? Which is like asking, you know, have you stopped beating your wife yet? I mean, there's no... Say no, say yes, what are you going to do? So that's how it started. They invited me to come. I declined their invitation. I couldn't leave Scotland. I couldn't get it in myself. The word of the Lord came a second time, as it were, to Jonah, saying, go to Nineveh. I went to Nineveh, and I've been there for the last 29 years. And apparently I'm getting invited over here to Tarshish. All right. Could you comment a little on the need or not to be careful in avoiding Christian jargon, though biblical, in sparking spiritual conversation while we fully integrate with our culture? I can on that. I can, because every so often I find myself in a situation where somebody does this to me. I was buying soap. I like buying soap. You don't need to know everything about me, but I'm just telling you, I like buying soap. So I was in a shop buying soap, and a lady came in and recognized me. I was talking to the proprietor, who is a Jewish lady, and sort of, you know, building little bridges. This lady came in and bombed the bridge, you know, within about 15 seconds with a bunch of hallelujahs, praise the Lord, and oh mighty, mighty, glorious, gloriousnesses, you know. Just completely, just blah, la 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 la, you know, like every evangelical cliche that you've ever come across. She was well-meaning, but actually it was not helpful in that situation. The language of Zion is not necessarily the best language for communicating with our culture. And part of the skill in it is in being able to contextualize truth in a way that gives up none of the truth in the way in which it's conveyed. And that's why it's difficult. That's why it's often easier for us to revert to sort of familiar terminology, because we can be pretty sure then that we haven't, you know, that we've said what you're supposed to say. Well, we may have said it according to the expectations of whatever, but it may not actually intersect. I'm scrambling here to think of just a good illustration of something. I mean, you know, I'm always trying to work on the basis of where the person is. I'm sure you are too. So, for example, Jesus with the woman at the well does not begin, you know, Hey, out here by yourself, huh? Yeah. I don't see any other women out here in the middle of the day. So it's true what I heard. You've had five husbands and you got a live-in lover. I got to talk to you. No. Could I have a drink of water, please? And that's the start. So you're with an IT guy or an IT girl. So let's start with IT, whatever that means, information technology. You know, let's talk software. Let's talk about, you know, whether the real genius in the iPhone is actually in the, you know, the sexy externals of it, or is in all the genius that is in that tiny little mechanism. And that really the genius in the mechanism is absolutely crucial to whatever is represented on the outside. And so we can think about, you know, from the inside to the outside in terms of character, in terms of faith, and so on. And I think it is a useful exercise, even when you're preaching. And I would distinguish between contexts. I mean, I assume a context here that has been put together by this church and it's largely church people and everything else. I would not necessarily have said all the things that I've said in the way in which I've said them were I in a different context. And I try and, in my speaking, keep in mind, I try and imagine that there are five families from my immediate neighborhood who are actually sitting out there. You know, so some are Jewish and some are whatever they are. And I try and listen to things through their ears a little bit. And whether you're actually making contact or not. You may be satisfying the faithful because you're ringing their chimes, but you may not actually be penetrating them. And the same is true in interpersonal conversation. That's a good question, lousy answer. All right. How is your wife recovering from her ALS surgery? Pretty well. I'm going to go home and find out. She fell in Scotland and tore, I can't tell you why. I could, but I don't want to. And it was my fault, and she tore her MCL and her ACL, and she had the reconstructive surgery a week ago Thursday, because this is Saturday now. Was it? I don't know. When did I come here? Wednesday. Yeah, a week ago. So she's doing good, I think. I'll find out. I'm going to go home and chase her down the stairs. Here's a question about, can you please comment on what I believe to be a hyper-spiritualization of finding the one for marriage, compounded by singles ministries that chastise one's desire for marriage and call it discontent, and then give them a list of 182 things needed in a partner before marrying? Man, you're in a bad singles ministry, I gotta tell you. Ironically, in the age of choice, we're choosing to do nothing. As a father, it disheartens me to see all those godly young women being looked over. When I met my wife, there was no writing in the sky, and I didn't feel like she was, quote, the one. In fact, we were friends many years before someone finally said to me, hey, what about? And it's been an incredible journey. Men, we are missing what God has placed right in front of us. Get married. Thank you. That's a sermon right there. Starts as a question, ends as a declaration. All unmarried men, get married. That's the word. Do not wait for writing in the sky. If you're sitting next to a woman, marry her. That's the word right here. Okay? I'd like to thank you for that insight. That was brilliant. It's tough, isn't it? It's tough. Because, you know, Swindoll says you can't just give your daughter to anybody. You know, you give your daughter, it's like giving your prized Stradivarius to a gorilla. And you just can't do that. But there is a real need for sanity and clarity, and we can probably learn from the Muslims quite a bit in this regard, and from other Eastern contexts who believe in arranged marriage. I actually kind of believe in arranged marriage as well. It gets everybody ticked off when I say that, but in the sense that your girls or your boys, they come down in the morning and go, do you like my shoes? Do you think I can wear these? And you have this big discussion. They change 15 times. You know, they're 13 years old or 15 years old. And you go through all of this, all their identity crisis and all the development of their things and everything else. And then all of a sudden, they come walking in the house one day. And they go, this is Rodney. And I'm going to marry him. No, you are not. What are you talking about? You couldn't even choose your shoes. How? What are you doing? Get serious. Get in the bedroom. We're going to have a conversation. Rodney, get out. We'll call you if we need you. Get out, Rodney. Well, that goes over really well with your daughters, as you can tell. And I'm overstating it for the fun of it. But there's a tremendous amount involved in this. And there is a lot of folly. And there is a lot of, you know, over-spiritualization of things. I'm thinking of Fiddler on the Roof, you know. Do you love me? Do you love me? You know. And then that great line, because my father and my mother said we learn to love each other, you know. And that there really, really, really is something in that. And so weaning our kids away from the kind of infatuation factor or for stimulation that is entirely physical or whatever, is a big challenge and a necessary one, and the question highlights it, and the answer is no good. I have a friend. Well, good for you. Who has approached me about my faith and has a genuine interest in the gospel. His hesitation lies in the fact that years ago he lost his son and cannot understand why a loving God would take his child. What would you say? That is tough. That is tough. I remember walking around the street with one of my neighbors, a young lady whose mom had just died. And we were walking, this is years ago now, when I was probably still in my 20s, and we were walking around the corner. I was talking about how she lost her mom. Her mom professed no faith in Jesus. And I was explaining to this girl, you know, that our only hope in life and in death is in Christ. And she said, yeah, I get that. But I want to be with my mother. And if what you're saying is true, then my mother's not going to be where you're expecting me to go, and therefore I don't want to go there. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to hear your gospel. Well, obviously, no one's ever going to respond to the gospel on that sort of superficial level. They need to be brought to see their need of Christ and so on. But it is an understandable reaction. And that sense, I mean, you get it. What I would say to this fellow is one thing I would do is I would get him a Nicholas Walterstorff's little book, Lament for a Son. Walterstorff is a professor of divinity, I think, or religion. Is it at Yale? I can never remember, but he lost his son in a climbing accident. And it's the best little thing that I've ever read on a lament, you know, that actually says, this is dreadful. This is horrible, right? I think that non-Christian people we gain an entry by being prepared to acknowledge the place of lament, not by denying the place of lament. The sort of victory talk seems trite to them because they've got no notion of how you ever get there. And it may sound triumphalistic and rather unattractive. So I think that we can acknowledge that a significant number of the Psalms are laments. They're not jigs. They're played, if you like, on a lone bagpipe. And so I want to, first of all, try as best I can to get on the side of that individual. Then I have to say that in my experience, the providences of God, which is how I would describe the loss of this son, not a chance occurrence, but a because if God not only creates all things, but he sustains all things, if he is providentially in control of the universe, that we're not held in the grip of blind deterministic forces, and we're not cast about on the sea of chance, if that is true, it has to be true in the good and in the bad. Therefore, I have to say to the person that the providences of God, in my experience, are seldom self-interpreting. In other words, that I cannot look at this and give an answer to this right now, any more than I can give an answer to a lot of things that I've gone through in my life. And I wouldn't try and do you the disservice of trying to come up with some kind of slick way to give you an answer to this. But here are the facts. You know them. Now, either we can say, I'm going to curse God and die. Or we can say, because I don't understand. Or we can say, I do not understand. But I'm going to investigate this God. And I'm going to try and wrestle with the implications of what it means that he took his one and only son. And that he put him to death for the sinner. And I'm going to wrestle with the fact that Christianity introduces me to a God who's not on a deck chair, but a God who's on a cross. And then through that prism, I'm going to try and move on from there. But these are the conversations that continue, I think, over time. And sometimes when we can't talk to our friends about God, we have to remind ourselves that we can always talk to God about men. And often more progress is actually made in our silences than in sometimes we're tempted, depending on how we're constituted, to just be jabbering all the time, thinking that in an abundance of words, we're finally going to hit on something. A couple more and we'll stop. What single parenting advice would you deem necessary in raising up a teenage girl? Tell her not to come home with Rodney. No. Oh, single piece of advice. Well, so this is advice that I'm going to give to a parent, not to the child. What single parenting advice would you deem? So I'm going to advise you? Okay. Seize the opportunities of last thing in the day to sit on the floor in her bedroom and give her the freedom to talk if she wants to talk or to be silent if she wants to be silent. Create a context in which you as her dad give her tons of hugs, assure her of everything good and nice that you see in her character before you express it in relationship to her looks. And affirm her in her identity as a young lady and do all of that stuff. But I think, you know, the idea in the Shema of these things are to be upon your hearts, and you will talk about them when you walk along the road and when you lie down and when you get up. In other words, this is not a Bible study course on parenting techniques. This is a way of life. And our kids, they know whether we're giving them the goods or, you know, whether we're on our thing or whatever it is. And I don't know, I need my daughters here to answer to this, but sometimes, you know, at the end of the day, I just go in and lie on top of their bed with them. And sometimes they would tell me about school. Sometimes they would ask me about something. Sometimes they would have a concern that may actually just come out after a time of silence. That may seem like a silly suggestion, but that's all I can think of at the moment. What Bible translation are you using? Well, I've been using two because I realized that you didn't use the ESV, which is what I started with last night. And then I switched to the New International Version. And if I was staying any longer, I'd be in the New King James Version probably. So I did it say in passing that Daniel became a eunuch in the hands of the Babylonians. No, it didn't. But it did use the word eunuch in the way that I think the King James Version uses it. But it did not say that of Daniel. Last evening, how does a woman develop a meek and quiet spirit based on 1 Peter 3? Also, what does it look like for a woman to be feminine yet strong, totally yielded to the lordship of Christ in this culture? What does it look like? It looks attractive. It looks unusual. And it is that wonderful strength and submission, you know. We don't have time to get this going, do we? But, you know, Adam and Eve, Adam, you got a responsibility here. Eve, so do you. The sort of caricature of the strength of the male or the strength of the husband and the submissiveness of the woman is like Adam's, you know, he's sitting there and he's going, "Hey, don't put the daffodils there. I told you I want the daffodils over on the left-hand side. I'm Adam. You're Eve. And the tulips, get them over there." Do you think that's how we're supposed to be? No. Adam's like, "What are we supposed to do with the daffodils?" She goes, "That's why I'm here. I can show you what to do with them." So you can't really have the benefits of this submissive beauty, the gentle and a quiet spirit, You know, don't let your thing be, you know, the braiding of your hair or the wearing of gold jewelry, but let it be the unending beauty, attractive beauty of a gentle and a quiet spirit. You know, that gentle and a quiet spirit has to be, you know, that jewel has to be set against the dark velvet, against the black velvet, like in the jeweler's store. The dark velvet has to be the engagement of the husband fulfilling the role of sacrificial leadership so that he sacrifices himself for the well-being of his wife. And he's prepared to do that, and it is a sacrifice in order to lead, in the same way that it is a sacrifice in order to follow. That's why many guys are not prepared to make the sacrifice. So they've taken their hands off the steering wheel, the hands off everything. And their wives are doing everything. Where are we going on vacation? She'll figure it out. What are we going to do Thursday? She'll decide. When do we leave for so-and-so? She'll get it fixed. No. Get up, you lazy rascal. It's time for you to be doing some things. It's time for you to be thinking. You can't lay all that burden on your wife. The fact that she's a genius and very good and better than you at 80% of it is no excuse for you getting out of it. You got a job to do. So you got to love her sacrificially. You got to lead her sacrificially, and then it creates a context for her. And so obviously what it means is you can't braid your hair. That's what it looks like. No braiding of the hair. And only silver jewelry. So that's what it looks like. If you and maybe if you do your hair up to just to a large point, and dye it emerald green, and wear just huge honking big, you know, emeralds and silver jewelry, the people will go, oh, she must be obeying First Peter, because she didn't braid her hair and she wasn't using gold jewelry. I make that point to just show you again how to interpret the Bible. That would be legitimate, wouldn't it? Why are you doing that with your hair? Well, we're not allowed to braid it. What are you doing with those huge big things hanging around like this? Why are you doing that? Well, you're not supposed to wear gold. You missed the whole cotton picking point, for goodness sake. Right? Okay. Last 4 minutes. Last evening you mentioned God is always in control and that on November the 6th something bad might happen to the nation so that something good might happen to the church. Right? You also mentioned biblical values, including the sanctity of marriage, sanctity of life, religious liberty, economic morality. Biblical speaking, this election appears to present a clear choice, yet evangelical church leaders cannot seem to find their voice, as Daniel did not defile himself with the royal food and wine. My three-part question pertains to how church leaders should be educating their bodies and the nation regarding November 6th. One, are you suggesting that Christians seek an awakening in the church after a bad result for the nation happens on November 6th, or for Christians to vote for a good result for the nation on November 6th? Both. You exercise the privileges of democracy, pray like a crazy person, and vote. And tell your friends as well, and engage them in conversation, especially the strange group of people that exist in this country that are, quote, undecideds. How can you be undecided? What's up with, are you in here as an undecided? Talk to me. What can't you decide? This is chalk and cheese. This is light and darkness. What are you talking about? Anyway, so talk to those people. They need a little bit of a conversation. And exercise the privileges of your democracy. Two, should Christians vote biblical values, i.e. stand up for the unborn, the sanctity of marriage, and religious liberty, or is there room to compromise on these issues because of other concepts like economic fairness or the environment as a higher priority? This is a heck of a question. It's a very good question, isn't it? Because it is so very complex. Because the issues of economic fairness are real issues. The issues of economy here, this is about the economy, stupid. Okay? This is, you need Margaret Thatcher here right now. You need Margaret Thatcher to come and say, look, this is how my father ran the grocery store. He didn't borrow, and he only stocked what he could sell. And this is how we hit it. All we've got here is a gigantic grocery store. And this grocery store has been borrowing, and we're absolutely up the creek. So we're going to have to stop that right now. We're going to have to stop giving money away to everybody in the world. We're going to have to stop looking after all those people. We'd like to do that, but we can't do that. Why? Because we ain't got no money. So it's about that as well. It's about the economies of that as it relates to people. I come from the land of socialized medicine. So, you know, you want to have that conversation? We can have that conversation. I have in my congregation people that cover the entire economic and political spectrum. Therefore, what is my job? My job is to tell the people, vote. My job is to encourage people to think. My job is to remind them that whether it's to their pleasure or to their disgust on November the 6th, the Lord God Omnipotent reigns. And even if it doesn't seem so, it is so. And therefore, quit spazzing out about this. And get yourself under control. And yes, the issues of morality matter. And yes, the issues of all these things are a concern. There's a radical distinction between upholding the strength of the nuclear family and what that means in terms of the redefinition of marriage and all those things. They all play into these decisions. The trouble is, it's not easy to isolate all these things and to get them in one clean package. That doesn't mean that I'm any personally unclear about anything in my own mind. I'm absolutely clear, but I don't believe that my responsibility is to try and influence others in relationship to actually the way they do it. What is the role of the church with respect to the elections in America, and where is our voice not to defile the church like Daniel with the royal food and wine? I think that if you teach through the Bible, you teach your congregation, and out of your instruction of the congregation, which has covered matters of morality and economics and what it means to be a Christian in the world, what it means to be a Christian businessman, what it means to be a compassionate Christian, what it means to care about the poor, what it means to deal with all of these things. If you have been laying that groundwork over time, then the congregation will be able to bring those principles to bear upon the way in which they make decisions. And that, I think, is the responsibility of the pastor. I'm not inclined to sign up for whatever the Sunday is where, you know, we're going to stick it to the IRS or whatever else it is, and I'm going to stand up and then they're going to send my stuff to the IRS and take them on and challenge them and do whatever it is. I understand the motivation in that. I find no sense of it doesn't appeal to me. It doesn't do anything for me at all. Because at the end of the day, when I walk down the street in my community, there are Muslims there. There are Hindus there, there are fundamentalist Baptists there, there are all kinds, there's all kinds of scary people there, and we got to try and work out our own salvation with fear and trembling. 12:16, Edward, my man, I'm going to try and make a run for it here before anyone catches me, but thank you for the privilege of coming. Thank you.